Left and right, she sent the beam of her light into this place where she had fallen. It was a long room directly beneath the passage she had taken from the great chamber. The entire length of it was piled with melange. Odred probed upward with her light and saw why no searcher tapping on that passage floor overhead had detected this chamber. Crisscrossed rock bracings transferred all strain deep into the stone walls. Anyone tapping overhead would get back the sounds of solid rock. Once more, Odred looked at the melange around her. Even at today's tank-deflated prices, she knew she was standing on a treasure. This hoard would measure many long tons. Is that the danger? The warning sense within her remained just as acute as ever. The tyrant's melange was not what she should fear. The triumvirate would make an equitable distribution of this lot, and that would be the end of it. A bonus in the Gola project. Another danger remained. She could not avoid the warning. Again she sent the light beam along the mounded melange. Her attention was drawn to the strip of wall above the spice. More words. Still on Jacobsa, written with a cutter in a fine flowing script, there was another message. A reverend mother will read my words. Something cold settled in Odred's guts. She moved to her right with the light, plowing through an empire's ransom in melange. There was more to the message. I bequeath to you my fear and loneliness. To you I give the certainty that the body and soul of the Bene Gesserit will meet the same fate as all other bodies and all other souls. Another paragraph of the message beckoned to the right of this one. She plowed through the cloying melange and stopped to read. What is survival if you do not survive whole? Ask the Bene Tlilax that. What if you no longer hear the music of life? Memories are not enough unless they call you to noble purpose. There was more of it on the narrow end wall of the long chamber. Odred stumbled through the melange and knelt to read. Why did your sisterhood not build the golden path? You knew the necessity. Your failure condemned me, the God Emperor, to millennia of personal despair. The words God Emperor were not in Chocobsa, but in the language of the Islamiyat, where they conveyed an explicit second meaning to any speaker of that tongue. Your God and your Emperor, because you made me so. Odred smiled grimly. That would drive Waf into a religious frenzy. The higher he went, the easier to shatter his security. She did not doubt the accuracy of the tyrant's accusation, nor the potential in his prediction that the sisterhood could end. The sense of danger had led her to this place unerringly. Something more had been at work, too. The worms of Rakis still moved to the tyrant's ancient beat. He might slumber in his endless dream, but monstrous life, a pearl in each worm to remind it, carried on as the tyrant had predicted. What was it he had told the sisterhood in his own time? She recalled his words. When I am gone, they must call me Shaitan, Emperor of Gehenna. The wheel must turn and turn along the golden path. Yes, that was what Taraza had meant. But don't you see, the common people of Rakis have been calling him Shaitan for more than 1,000 years. So Taraza had known this thing. Without ever seeing these words, she had known. I see your design, Taraza. And now I know the burden of fear you have carried all these years. I can feel it every bit as deeply as you do. Odred knew then that this warning sense would not leave until she ended, or the sisterhood vanished from existence, or the peril was resolved. Odred lifted her light, got to her feet, and slogged through the melange to the wine steps out of this place. At the steps she recoiled. More of the tyrant's words had been cut into each riser. Trembling, she read them as they moved upward to the opening. My words are your past. My questions are simple. With whom do you ally? with the self-idolaters of Tlilax, with my fish-speaker bureaucracy, with the cosmos-wandering guild, with Harkonnen blood sacrificers, with a dogmatic sink of your own creation, how will you meet your end as no more than a secret society? Odraid climbed past the questions, reading them a second time as she went. Noble purpose. What a fragile thing that always was, and how easily distorted. But the power was there, immersed in constant peril. It was all spelled out on the walls and stairs of that chamber. Terraza knew without having it explained. The tyrant's meaning was clear. Join me. As she emerged into the small room, finding a narrow ledge along which she could swing herself to the door, Odraid looked down at the treasure she had found. She shook her head in wonder at Terraza's wisdom. So that was how the sisterhood might end. Terraza's design was clear. All the pieces in place. Nothing certain. Wealth and power. It was all the same in the end. The noble design had been started, and it must be completed, even if that meant the death of the sisterhood. What poor tools we have chosen. That girl waiting back there in the deep chamber below the desert. That girl and the Gola being prepared on Rakkas. I speak your language now, old worm. It has no words, but I know the heart of it. Our fathers ate manna in the desert, in the burning place where whirlwinds came. Lord, save us from that horrible land. Save us. Oh, save us from that dry and thirsty land. Songs of Gurney Halleck, Museum of Daris Balat. Teg and Duncan, both heavily armed, emerged from the no-globe with Lucilla into the coldest part of the night. The stars were like needlepoints overhead, the air absolutely still until they disturbed it. The dominant smell in Teg's nostrils was the brittle mustiness of snow. The odor infused every breath, and when they exhaled, fat clouds of vapor puffed around their faces. Tears of cold started in Duncan's eyes. He had been thinking much of old Gurney as they prepared to leave the no-globe. Gurney with his cheek scarred by a Harkonnen ink-vine whip. Trusted companions would be needed now, Duncan thought. He did not trust Lucilla much, and Teg was old. Old. Duncan could see Teg's eyes glinting in the starlight. Slinging a heavy antique laser gun over his left shoulder, Duncan thrust his hands deep into his pockets for warmth. He had forgotten how cold this planet could get. Lucilla seemed impervious to it, obviously drawing warmth from one of her Bene Gesserit tricks. Looking at her, Duncan realized he had never trusted the witches much, not even the Lady Jessica. It was easy to think of them as traitors, devoid of any loyalty except to their own sisterhood. They had so damned many secret tricks. Lucilla had given up her seductive ways, though. She knew he meant what he had said. He could feel her anger simmering. Let her simmer. Teg stood quite still, his attention focused outward, listening. Was it right to trust the single plan he and Burzmali had worked out? They had no backup. Was it only 8 days ago they had settled on it? It felt longer despite the press of preparations. He glanced at Duncan and Lucilla. Duncan carried a heavy old Harkonnen laser gun, the long field model. Even the extra charge cartridges were heavy. Lucilla had refused to carry more than a single tiny laser gun in her bodice. One small burst was all it held, an assassin's toy. We of the Sisterhood are noted for going into battle with only our skills as weapons, she said. It diminishes us to change that pattern. She had knives in her leg sheaths, though. Teg had seen them. Poison on them, too, he suspected. Teg hefted the long weapon in his own hands, a modern field-style laser gun he had brought from the keep. Over his shoulder, a mate to Duncan's weapon hung from its sling. "I must rely on Brzmali," Teg told himself. "I trained him. I know his qualities. If he says we trust these new allies, we trust them." Brzmali had been obviously overjoyed to find his old commander alive and safe. But it had snowed since their last encounter, and the snow lay all around them, a tabula rasa upon which all tracks would be written. They had not counted on snow. Were there traitors in weather management? Teg shivered. The air was cold. It felt like the chill of off-planet space, empty and giving starlight free access to the forest glade around them. The thin light reflected cleanly off the snow-covered ground and the white dusting on the rocks. Dark outlines of conifers and the leafless branches of deciduous trees displayed only their whitely diffused edges. All else was deepest shadow. Lucilla blew on her fingers and leaned close to Teg to whisper, "Shouldn't he be here by now?" He knew that was not her real question. Can Brzmali be trusted? That was her question. She had been asking it one way and another ever since Teg had explained the plan to her 8 days ago. All he could say was, "I have staked my life on it." Our lives, too. Teg, too, disliked the accumulated uncertainties, but all plans relied ultimately on the skills of those who executed them. "You're the one who insisted we must get out of there and go on to Rakkis," he reminded her. He hoped she could see his smile, a gesture to take the sting out of his words. Lucilla was not placated. Teg had never seen a Reverend Mother this obviously nervous. She would be even more nervous if she knew of their new allies. Of course, there was the fact that she had failed to carry out her full assignment from Terraza. How that must gall her. "We took an oath to protect the Gola," she reminded him. "Brzmali has taken that same oath." Teg glanced at Duncan standing silently between them. Duncan gave no sign that he heard the argument or shared the nervousness. An ancient composure held his features motionless. He was listening to the night, Teg realized. Doing what all three of them should be doing just now. There was an odd look of ageless maturity on his young features. "If ever I needed trusted companions, it's now," Duncan thought. His mind had gone questing backward into the Gaidi Prime days of his pre-Gola roots. That was what they had called a Harkonnen night. Safe within the warm shielding of their suspensor-buoyed armor, the Harkonnens had enjoyed hunting their subjects on such nights. A wounded fugitive could die of the cold. The Harkonnens knew. Damn their souls. Predictably, Lucilla caught Duncan's attention with a look that said, "We have unfinished business, you and I." Duncan turned his face up into the starlight, making sure she could see his smile. An offensive and knowing look that caused Lucilla to stiffen inwardly. He slipped the heavy laser gun from his shoulder and checked it. She noted the ornate scrollwork on its stock and along the barrel. It was an antique, but still it gave off a deadly sense of purpose. Duncan rested it over his left arm, right hand on the grip, finger on the trigger, exactly as Teg was carrying his own modern weapon. Lucilla turned her back on her companions and sent her senses probing onto the hillside above them and below. Even as she moved, sound erupted all around. Globs of sound filled their night. A great burst of rumblings off to the right, then silence. Another burst from downslope, silence. From upslope, on all sides. At the first sound, all three of them crouched into the shelter of the rocks outside the No-Globe's cave entrance. The sounds filling their night carried little definition. Intrusive racketing, partly mechanical, partly squeaks and wails and hisses. Intermittently, a subterranean drumming made the ground vibrate. Teg knew these sounds. There was a battle going on out there. He could hear the background hissing of burners and in the distant sky, the lancing beams of armored laser guns. Something flashed overhead, trailing blue and red sparks. Another and another. The earth trembled. Tag inhaled through his nose. Burned acid and a suggestion of garlic. No ships. Many of them. They were landing in the valley below the ancient snow globe. Back inside, Tag ordered. As he spoke, he saw it was too late. People were moving in from all around them. Tag lifted his long laser gun and aimed it downslope toward the loudest of the intrusive noises and the nearest detectable movement. Many people could be heard shouting down there. Free glow globes moved along the screening trees, set loose by whoever came from there. The dancing lights drifted upslope on a cold breeze. Dark figures moved in the shifting illumination. Face dancers, Tag grunted, recognizing the attackers. Those drifting lights would be clear of the trees within seconds, and on his position in less than a minute. We've been betrayed, Lucilla said. A great shout roared from the hill above them. Bashar! Many voices. Where's Molly? Tag asked himself. He glanced back in that direction, and then down at the steadily advancing face dancers. No time to pick and choose. He leaned toward Lucilla. That's Brismali above us. Take Duncan and run. But what if it's your only chance? You fool, she accused, even as she turned to obey. Tag's yes did nothing to ease her fears. This was what came of depending on the plans of others. Duncan had other thoughts. He understood what Tag was about to do. Sacrifice himself that two might escape. Duncan hesitated, looking at the advancing attackers below them. Seeing the hesitation, Tag blared at him. This is a battle order! I am your commander! It was the closest thing to voice Lucilla had ever heard from a man. She gaped at Tag. Duncan saw only the face of the old Duke telling him to obey. It was too much. He grabbed Lucilla's arm, but before hustling her up the slope, he said, We'll lay down a covering fire once we're clear. Tag did not respond. He crouched against a snow-dusted rock as Lucilla and Duncan scrambled away. He knew he must sell himself dearly now. And there must be something else. The unexpected. A final signature from the old Bashar. The advancing attackers were coming up faster, exchanging excited shouts. Setting his laser gun on Maxibeam, Tag pressed the trigger. A fiery arc swept across the slope below him. Trees burst into flame and crashed. People screamed. The weapon would not perform long at this discharge level, but while it did, the carnage produced its desired effect. In the abrupt silence after that first sweep, Tag shifted his position to another screening rock on his left and again sent a flaming lance down the dark slope. Only a few of the drifting glow globes had survived that first slashing violence with its falling trees and dismembered bodies. More screams greeted his second counterattack. He turned and scrambled across the rocks to the other side of the no globe's access cave. There he sent sweeping fire down the opposite slope. More screams. More flames and crashing trees. No answering fire came back. They want us alive. The Tlilazu were prepared to spend whatever number of face dancers' lives it required to run his laser gun out of its charges. Tag shifted the sling of the old Harkonnen weapon to a better position on his shoulder, getting it ready to swing into action. He discarded the almost empty charge in his modern laser gun, recharged it, and rested the weapon across the rocks. Tag doubted he would get the chance to recharge the second weapon. Let them think down there that he had run out of charge cartridges. But there were two Harkonnen handguns in his belt as a last resort. They would be potent at close range. Some of the Tlilazu masters, the ones who ordered such carnage, let them come closer. Cautiously, Teg lifted his long lace gun from the rock and moved backward, drifting up into the higher rocks, slipping left and then right. He paused twice to sweep the slopes below him with short bursts, as though conserving the gun's charge. There was no sense in trying to conceal his movements. They would have a life tracer on him by now. And besides, there were the tracks in the snow. The unexpected. Could he suck them in close? Well above the no-globe's access cave, he found a deeper pocket in the rocks, its bottom filled with snow. Teg dropped into this position, admiring the fine field of fire this new vantage provided. He studied it briefly, protected behind him by higher crags and open downslope on three sides. He lifted his head cautiously and tried to see around the screening rocks upslope. Only silence there. Had that shout come from Burzmali's people? Even so, there was no guarantee that Duncan and Lucilla could escape in these circumstances. It depended on Burzmali now. Is he as resourceful as I always thought? There was no time to consider the possibilities or change a single element of the situation. Battle had been joined. He was committed. Teg drew a deep breath and peered downslope over the rocks. Yes, they had recovered and were resuming the advance. Without telltale glow globes this time, and silently now. No more shouts of encouragement. Teg rested the long laser gun on a rock in front of him, and swept a burning arc from left to right in one long burst, letting it fade out at the end in an obvious loss of charge. Unslinging the old Harkonnen weapon, he readied it, waiting in silence. They would expect him to flee up the hill. He crouched behind the screening rocks, hoping there was enough movement above him to confuse the life tracers. He still heard people below him on that fire-racked slope. Teg counted silently to himself, spacing out the distance, knowing from long experience how much time the attackers would require to come within deadly range. And he listened carefully for another sound he knew from previous encounters with the Tlilazu, the sharp barking of commands in high-pitched voices. There they were. The masters were spread out farther down slope than he had anticipated. Fearful creatures. Teg set the old laser gun on Maxabeam and lifted himself suddenly from his protective cradle in the rocks. He saw the arc of advancing face dancers in the light of burning trees and brush. The high-pitched voices of command came from behind the advance, well out of the dancing orange light. Aiming over the heads of the nearest attackers, Teg sighted beyond the jumble of flames and pressed the trigger, two long bursts back and forth. He was momentarily surprised by the extent of the destructive energy in the antique weapon. The thing, obviously, was the product of superb craftsmanship, but there had been no way to test it in the no-globe. This time the screams carried a different pitch, high and frantic. Teg lowered his aim and cleared the immediate slope of face dancers, letting them feel the full force of the beam, revealing that he carried more than one weapon. Back and forth he swept the deadly arc, giving the attackers plenty of time to see the charge ebb into a final sputter. Now. They have been sucked in once and would be more cautious. There just might be a chance to join Duncan and Lucilla. This thought full on his mind, Teg turned and scrambled out of his shelter across the upslope rocks. At his fifth step, he thought he had run into a hot wall. There was time for his mind to recognize what had happened. The shocking blast of a stunner full into his face and chest. It came from directly upslope where he had sent Duncan and Lucilla. Chagrin filled Teg as he fell into darkness. Others could do the unexpected too. All organized religions face a common problem. A tender spot through which we may enter and shift them to our designs. How do they distinguish hubris from revelation? Missionaria protectiva, the inner teachings. Odrade kept her gaze carefully away from the cool green of the quadrangle below her, where Shiana sat with one of the teaching sisters. The teaching sister was the best, precisely fitted to this next phase in Shiana's education. Terraza had chosen them all with care. "We proceed with your plan," Odrade thought. "But did you anticipate, Mother Superior, how we might be marked by a chance discovery here on Rakkas? Or was it chance?" Odrade sent her gaze over the lower rooftops to the spread of the Sisterhood's central stronghold on Rakkas. Rainbow tiles baked out there in glaring noon light. All of this ours. This was, she knew, quite the largest embassy the priests permitted in their holy city of Keen. And her presence in this Bene Gesserit stronghold defied the agreement she had made with Tuek. But that had been before the discoveries at C.H. Tomber. Besides, Tuek no longer really existed. The Tuek who marched the priestly precincts was a face dancer living out a precarious charade. Odrade brought her thoughts back to Wath, who stood with two guardian sisters behind her, waiting near the door of this penthouse sanctuary with its fine view through armor plaza windows, and its impressive black furnishings, into which a robed Reverend Mother might blend, with only the lighter shades of her face visible to a visitor. Had she gauged WAP correctly? Everything had been done precisely according to Missionaria Protectiva teachings. Had she opened the crack in his psyche armor sufficiently? He should be goaded to speak soon. Then she would know. Waff stood back there calmly enough. She could see his reflection in the plaza. He gave no sign of understanding that the two tall, dark-haired sisters flanking him were there to prevent his possible violence. But he certainly knew. My guardians, not his. He stood with his head bent to conceal his features from her, but she knew he was uncertain. That part was sure. Doubts could be like a starving animal, and she had fed those hungry doubts well. He had been so sure that their venture into the desert would be the occasion for his death. His Zen Sunni and Sufi beliefs were telling him now that God's will preserved him there. Surely, though, Waff was reviewing now his agreement with the Bene Gesserit, seeing at last the ways he had compromised his people. How he had put his precious Tlilazu civilization in terrible jeopardy. Yes, his composure was wearing thin, but only Bene Gesserit eyes detected this. It would be time soon to begin rebuilding his awareness into a pattern more amenable to the Sisterhood's needs. Let him stew a bit longer. Odrade returned her attention to the view, loading the suspense of this delay. The Bene Gesserit had chosen this embassy location because of the extensive rebuilding that had changed the entire northeastern quarter of the old city. They could build and remodel here in their own way, and for their own purposes. Ancient structures designed for easy access by people on foot, wide lanes for official ground cars, and occasional squares in which ornithopters might land. All of that had been changed. Keeping up with the times. These new buildings stood much closer to the green planted avenues, whose tall and exotic trees flaunted their enormous water consumption. Thopters were relegated to rooftop landing pads on selected buildings. Pedestrian lanes clung to narrow elevations attached to the buildings. Coin-operated, key-operated, and palm identification lip slots had been inset into the new buildings, their glowing energy fields masked by dark brown, vaguely transparent covers. The lip slots were spines of dark color in the flat gray of plascrete and plaz. Humans dimly seen in the tubes gave the effect of impurities moving up and down in otherwise pure mechanical sausages. All in the name of modernization. Waff stirred behind her and cleared his throat. Odrade did not turn. The two guardian sisters knew what she was doing and gave no sign. Waff's mounting nervousness was merely confirmation that all went well. Audrey did not feel that all was going truly well. She interpreted the view out her window as just another disquieting symptom of this disquieting planet. Tuek, she recalled, had not liked this modernization of his city. He had complained that some way must be found to stop it and preserve the old landmarks. His face dance replacement continued that argument. How like Tuek himself this new face dancer was. Did such face dancers think for themselves, or just play out their parts in accordance with the master's orders? Were they still mules, these new ones? How much different were these face dancers from the fully human? Things about the deception worried Odrade. The false Tuek's counselors, the ones fully involved in what they thought of as the Tlilazu plot, spoke of public support for modernization and openly gloated that they had had their way at last. Albertus regularly reported everything to Odrade. Each new report worried her more. Even the obvious subservience of Albertus bothered her. Of course, the counselors do not mean public support, Albertus said. She could only agree. The behavior of the counselors signaled that they had powerful backing among the middle echelons of the priesthood, among the climbers who dared joke about their divided god at weekend parties, among those being soothed by the hoard Odrade had found at C.H. Tabor. 90,000 long tons. Half a year's harvest from the deserts of Rakkas. Even a third of it represented a significant bargaining chip in the new balances. I wish I'd never met you, Albertus. She had wanted to restore in him the one who cares. What she had actually done was easily recognized by one trained in the Missionaria Protectiva's ways. A groveling sycophant. It made no difference now that his subservience was driven by an absolute belief in her holy association with Shiana. Odrade had never before focused on how easily the Missionaria Protectiva's teachings destroyed human independence. That was always the goal, of course. Make them followers, obedient to our needs. The tyrant's words in that secret chamber had done more than ignite her fears for the sisterhood's future. I bequeath to you my fear and loneliness. From that millennial distance, he had planted doubts in her, as surely as she had planted them in Wath. She saw the tyrant's questions as though they had been limned with glowing lights on her inner eye. With whom do you ally? Are we no more than a secret society? How will we meet our end? In a dogmatic stink of our own creation? The tyrant's words had been burned into her consciousness. Where was the noble purpose in what the sisterhood did? Odrade could almost hear Taraza's sneering response to such a question. Survival, Dar. That's all the noble purpose we need. Survival. Even the tyrant knew that. Perhaps even Tuek had known it. And what had that brought him in the end? Odrade felt a haunting sympathy for the late High Priest. Tuek had been a superb example of what a tightly knit family could produce. Even his name was a clue, unchanged from Atreides' days on this planet. The founding ancestor had been a smuggler, confidant of the first Leto. Tuek had come from a family that held firmly to its roots, saying, "There is something worth preserving in our past." The example this set for descendants was not lost on a reverend mother. But you failed, Tuek. These blocks of modernization visible out her window were a sign of that failure, sops to the rising power elements in Rakkian society, those elements that the sisterhood had worked so long to foster and strengthen. Tuek had seen this as a harbinger of the day when he would be too weak politically to prevent the things implied by such modernization. A shorter and more upbeat ritual. New songs, more in the modern manner. Changes in the dancing. Traditional dances take so long. Above all, fewer ventures into the dangerous desert for the young postulants from the powerful families. Odred sighed and glanced back at Waff. Little Tlilazu chewed his lower lip. Good. Damn you, Albertus. I would welcome your rebellion. Behind the closed doors of the temple, the transition of the high priesthood already was being debated. The new Rakian spoke of the need to keep up with the times. They meant, give us more power. It has always been this way, Odred thought, even in the Bene Gesserit. Still, she could not escape the thought. Poor Tuek. Albertus reported that Tuek, just before his death and replacement by the Face Dancer, had warned his kin they might not retain familial control of the high priesthood when he died. Tuek had been more subtle and resourceful than his enemies expected. His family already was calling in its debts, gathering its resources to retain a power base. And the Face Dancer in Tuek's place revealed much by his mimic performance. The Tuek family had not yet learned of the substitution, and one might almost believe the original High Priest had not been replaced, so good was this Face Dancer. Observing that Face Dancer in action betrayed much to the watchful Reverend Mothers. That, of course, was one of the things that had Waff squirming now. Odred turned abruptly on one heel and strode across to the Tlilazu master. Time to have at him. She stopped 2 paces from Waff and glared down at him. Waff met her gaze with defiance. You've had enough time to consider your position, she accused. Why do you remain silent? My position? You think you give us a choice? Man is but a pebble dropped in a pool, she quoted at him from his own beliefs. Waff took a trembling breath. She spoke the proper words, but what lay behind such words? They no longer sounded right coming from the mouth of a Pawindo woman. When Waff did not respond, Odred continued her quotation. And if man is but a pebble, then all his works can be no more. An involuntary shudder swept through Odred, causing a look of carefully masked surprise in the watchful guardian sisters. That shudder was not part of the required performance. Why do I think of the tyrant's words at this moment? Odred wondered. The body and soul of the Bene Gesserit will meet the same fate as all other bodies and all other souls. His barb had gone deep into her. How was I made so vulnerable? The answer leaped into her awareness. The Atreides Manifesto. Composing those words under Terraza's watchful guidance opened a flaw within me. Could that have been Terraza's purpose, to make Odred vulnerable? How could Terraza have known what would be found here on Rakkis? The Mother Superior not only displayed no prescient abilities, she tended to avoid this talent in others. On the rare occasions when Terraza had demanded such a performance of Odred herself, the reluctance had been obvious to the trained eye of a sister. Yet she made me vulnerable. Had it been an accident? Odred sank into a swift recital of the litany against fear. Only a few eye blinks, but in that time Waff visibly came to a decision. You would force it upon us, he said. But you do not know what powers we have reserved for such a moment. He lifted his sleeves to show where the dart throwers had been. These were but paltry toys by comparison with our real weapons. The sisterhood has never doubted this, Odred said. Is it to be violent conflict between us? He asked. It is your choice to make, she said. Why do you court violence? There are those who would love to see Bene Gesserit and Bene Tlilax at each other's throats, Odred said. Our enemies would enjoy stepping in to pick up the pieces after we had weakened ourselves sufficiently. You state the argument for agreement, but you give my people no room to negotiate. Perhaps your Reverend Mother gave you no authority to negotiate. How tempting it was to pass it all back into Terrazza's hands, just as Terrazza wanted. Odraid glanced at the guardian sisters. The two faces were masks betraying nothing. What did they really know? Would they realize if she went against Terrazza's orders? Do you have such authority? Waff persisted. Noble purpose, Odraid thought. Surely the tyrant's golden path demonstrated at least one quality of such purpose. Odraid decided on a creative truth. I have such authority, she said. Her own words made it true. Having taken the authority, she made it impossible for Terrazza to deny it. Odraid knew, though, that her own words committed her to a course sharply divergent from the sequential steps of Terrazza's design. Independent action. The very thing she had desired of Albertus. But I am on the scene, and know what is needed. Odraid glanced at the guardian sisters. Remain here, please, and see that we are not disturbed. To Wav, she said, we might as well be comfortable. She indicated two chair dogs set at right angles to each other across the room. Odraid waited until they were seated before resuming the conversation. We require a degree of candor between us that diplomacy seldom allows. Too much hangs in the balance for us to engage in shallow evasions. Waff looked at her strangely. He said, we know there is dissension in your highest councils. Subtle overtures have been made to us. Is this part of... I am loyal to the sisterhood, she said. Even those who approached you had no other loyalty. Is this another trick of... No tricks. With the Bene Gesserit, there are always tricks, he accused. What is it you fear from us? Name it. Perhaps I have learned too much from you for you to allow me to go on living. Could I not say the same of you? She asked. Who else knows of our secret affinity? There is no Pawinda female talking to you here. She had ventured the word with some trepidation, but the effect could not have been more revealing. Waff was visibly shaken. He was a long minute recovering. Doubts remained, though, because she had planted them in him. What do words prove? He asked. You might still take the things you have learned from me and leave my people nothing. You still hold the whip over us. I carry no weapons in my sleeves, Odraid said. But in your mind is knowledge that could ruin us. He glanced back at the guardian sisters. They are part of my arsenal, Odraid agreed. Shall I send them away? And in their minds, everything they have heard here, he said. He returned his wary gaze to Odraid. Better if you all sent your memories away. Odraid pitched her voice in its most reasonable tones. What would we gain by exposing your missionary zeal before you are ready to move? Would it serve us to blacken your reputation by revealing where you have placed your new face dancers? Oh, yes, we know about Ix and the fish speakers. Once we had studied your new ones, we went searching for them. You see? His voice was dangerously edged. I see no other way to prove our affinity than to reveal something equally damaging about ourselves, Odraid said. Waff was speechless. We would plant the worms of the prophet on uncounted planets of the scattering, she said. What would the Rakian priesthood say and do if you revealed that? The guardian sisters looked at her with thinly masked amusement. They thought she was lying. I have no guards with me, Waff said. When only one person knows a dangerous thing, how easy it is to gain that person's eternal silence. She lifted her empty sleeves. He looked at the guardian sisters. Very well, Odraid said. She glanced at the sisters and gave a subtle hand sign to reassure them. Wait outside, please, sisters. When the door closed behind them, Waff returned to his doubts. My people have not searched these rooms. What do I know of the things that could be hidden here to record our words? Odraid shifted into the language of the Islamiyat. Then perhaps we should speak another tongue, one known only to us. Waff's eyes glittered. In the same tongue he said, Very well, I will gamble on it. But I ask you to tell me the real cause of dissension among the Bene Gesserit. Odraid allowed herself a smile. With the change of language, Waff's entire personality, his whole manner, changed. He was performing exactly as expected. None of his doubts had been reinforced in this tongue. She responded with an equal confidence. Fools fear that we may bring back another Kwisatz Haderach. That is what a few of my sisters argue. There is no need of such a one, Waff said. The one who could be many places simultaneously has been, and he has gone. He came only to bring the prophet. God would not send such a message twice, she said. It was the very sort of thing Waff had heard often in this tongue. He no longer thought it strange that a woman could utter such words. The language and the familiar words were enough. Has Shuang Yu's death restored unity among your sisters? He asked. We have a common enemy, Odraid said. The honored Maters. You were wise to kill them and learn from them. Waff leaned forward, completely caught up in his familiar tongue and the flow of their conversation. They rule with sex, he exulted. Remarkable techniques of orgasmic amplification. We... Belatedly, he became aware of who was sitting in front of him, hearing all of this. We already know such techniques, Odraid reassured him. It will be interesting to compare, but there are obvious reasons why we have never tried to ride to power on such a dangerous conveyance. Those whores are just stupid enough to make that mistake. Mistake? He was clearly puzzled. They are holding the reins in their own hands, she said. As the power grows, their control of it must grow. The thing will shatter of its own momentum.
Power. Always power,
Waff muttered. Another thought struck him.
Are you saying this was how the prophet fell?
He knew what he was doing, she said. Millennia of enforced peace followed by the famine times and the scattering. A message of direct results. Remember, he did not destroy the Bene Tlilax or the Bene Gesserit.
For what do you hope from an alliance between our two peoples?
Waff asked. Hope is one thing, survival another, she said.
Always pragmatism, Waff said. And some among you fear that you may restore the prophet on Rakis with all of his powers intact.
Did I not say it? The language of the Islamiyat was particularly potent in this questioning form. It placed the burden of proof on Waff.
So they doubt God's hand in the creation of your Kwisatz Haderach, he said. Do they also doubt the prophet?
Very well. Let us have it all out in the open, Odraid said, and launched herself on the chosen course of deception. Shuang Yu and those who supported her broke away from the great belief. We harbor no anger toward any Bene Tlilax for having killed them. They saved us the trouble. Waff accepted this utterly. Given the circumstances, it was precisely what could be expected. He knew he had revealed much here that might better have been held in reserve, but there were still things the Bene Gesserit did not know, and the things he had learned. Odraid shocked him totally then by saying, Waff, if you think your descendants from the scattering have returned to you unchanged, then foolishness has become your way of life. He held himself silent. You have all of the pieces in your hands, she said. Your descendants belong to the whores of the scattering. And if you think any of them will abide by an agreement, then your stupidity goes beyond description. Waff's reactions told her she had him. The pieces were clicking into place. She had told him truth where it was required. His doubts were refocused where they belonged, against the people of the scattering. And it had been done in his own tongue. He tried to speak past a constriction in his throat and was forced to massage his throat before speech returned. What can we do? It's obvious. The Lost Ones have their eyes on us, just as one more conquest. They think of it as cleaning up behind them. Common prudence.
But they are so many.
Unless we unite in a common plan to defeat them, they will chew us up the way a slig chews up its dinner.
We cannot submit to Pawinda filth. God will not permit it.
Submit? Who suggests that we submit?
But the Bene Gesserit always used that ancient excuse. If you can't beat them, join them.
Odred smiled grimly. God will not permit you to submit. Do you suggest he will permit it of us?
Then what is your plan? What would you do against such numbers?
Exactly what you plan to do. Convert them. When you say the word, the sisterhood will openly espouse the true faith. Waff sat in stunned silence. So she knew the heart of the Tlilazu plan. Did she know also how the Tlilazu would enforce it? Odred stared at him, openly speculative. Grasp the beast by the balls if you must, she thought. But what if the projection by the sisterhood's analysts was wrong? This whole negotiation would be a joke in that case. And there was that look in the back of Waff's eyes, that suggestion of older wisdom, much older than his flesh. She spoke with more confidence than she felt. What you have achieved with Golas from your tanks and kept secretly for yourselves alone, others will pay a great price to achieve. Her words were sufficiently cryptic. Were others listening? But Waff did not doubt for an instant that the Bene Gesserit knew even this thing.
Will you demand a share in that as well? He asked.
The words rasped in his dry throat. Everything. We will share everything.
What will you bring to this great sharing?
Ask.
All of your breeding records.
They are yours.
Breeding mothers of our choice.
Name them. Waff gasped. This was far more than the Mother Superior had offered. It was like a blossom opening in his awareness. She was right about the honored maters, naturally, and about the Tlilazu descendants from the scattering. He had never completely trusted them. Never.
You will want an unrestricted source of melange, of course, he said.
Of course. He stared at her, hardly believing the extent of his good fortune. The Ixtlotl tanks would offer immortality only to those who espouse the great belief. No one would dare attack and attempt to seize a thing they knew the Tlilazu would destroy rather than lose. And now, he had gained the services of the most powerful and enduring missionary force known. Surely the hand of God was visible here. Waff was first awed and then inspired. He spoke softly to Odred.
And you, Reverend Mother, how do you name our accord?
Noble purpose, she said. You already know the prophet's words from C.H. Tabor. Do you doubt him?
Never, but there is one thing. What do you propose with that Gola of Duncan, Idaho, and the girl Shiana?
We will breed them, of course, and their descendants will speak for us to all of those descendants of the prophet.
On all of those planets where you would take them.
On all of those planets, she agreed. Waff sat back. I have you, Reverend Mother, he thought. We will rule this alliance, not you. The Gola is not yours. He is ours. Odred saw the shadow of his reservations in Waf's eyes, but knew she had ventured as much as she dared. More would reawaken doubts. Whatever happened, she had committed the sisterhood to this course. Terraza could not escape this alliance now. Waf squared his shoulders, a curiously juvenile gesture, belied by the ancient intelligence peering from his eyes.
"Ah, one thing more," he said,
every bit the master of masters speaking his own language and commanding all of those who heard him.
"Will you also help spread this Atreides manifesto?"
"Why not? I wrote it." Waf jerked forward.
"You? Did you think someone of lesser abilities could have done it?"
He nodded, convinced without further argument. This was fuel for a thought that had entered his own mind, a final point in their alliance. The powerful minds of Reverend Mothers would advise Tlilazu at every turn. What did it matter that they were outnumbered by those horrors of the scattering? Who could match such combined wisdom and insurmountable weapons? "The title of the manifesto is valid, too," Odred said. "I am a true descendant of the Atreides." "Would you be one of our breeders?" he ventured. "I am almost past the age of breeding, but I am yours to command." "I remember friends from wars all but we forgot, all of them distilled into each wound we caught. Those wounds are all the painful places where we fought, battles better left behind, ones we never sought. What is it that we spent, and what was it we bought? Songs of the Scattering." Burzmali based his planning on the best of what he had learned from his bashar, keeping his own counsel about multiple options and fallback positions. That was a commander's prerogative. Necessarily, he learned everything he could about the terrain. In the time of the Old Empire, and even under the reign of Moadib, the region around the Gamu Keep had been a forest reserve, high ground rising well above the oily residue that tended to cover Harkonnen land. On this ground, the Harkonnens had grown some of the finest pilingatum, a wood of steady currency, always valued by the supremely rich. From the most ancient times, the knowledgeable had preferred to surround themselves with fine woods rather than with the mass-produced artificial materials known then as polystein, polaz, and pomabat, laterally tine, laz, and bat. As far back as the Old Empire, there had been a pejorative label for the small rich and families minor, arising from the knowledge of a rare wood's value. "He's a 3PO, they said, meaning that such a person surrounded himself with cheap copies made from déclassé substances. Even when the supremely rich were forced to employ one of the distressful 3POs, they disguised it where possible behind OP, the only P, Pilingatum. Burzmali knew all of this and more as he set his people to searching for a strategically situated Pilingatum near the Noglobe. The wood of the tree had many qualities that endeared it to master artisans. Newly cut, it worked like a softwood. Dried and aged, it endured as a hardwood. It absorbed many pigments, and the finish could be made to appear as though it occurred naturally within the grain. More important, Pilingatum was antifungal, and no known insect had ever considered it a suitable dinner. Lastly, it was fire-resistant, and aged specimens of the living tree grew outward from an enlarged and empty tube at the core. "We will do the unexpected," Burzmali told his searchers. He had noted the distinctive lime green of Pilingatum leaves during his first overflight of the region. The forests of this planet had been raided and otherwise logged off during the famine times. But venerable OPs were still nurtured among the evergreens and hardwoods, replanted at the Sisterhood's orders. Burzmali's searchers found one such OP dominating a ridge above the Noglobe site. it spread its leaves over almost 3 hectares. On the afternoon of the critical day, Brismali placed decoys at a distance from this position and opened a tunnel from a shallow swale into the Pilingatum's roomy core. There he set up his command post and the backup necessities for escape. "The tree is a life form," he explained to his people. "It will mask us from tracers." The unexpected. Nowhere in his planning did Brismali assume that all of his actions would go undetected. He could only spread his vulnerability. When the attack came, he saw that it appeared to follow a predicted pattern. He had anticipated that attackers would rely on no-ships and great numbers, as they had in the assault on the Gamu Keep. The Sisterhood's analysts assured him that the major threat was from forces out of the scattering, descendants of the Tlilazu deployed by wildly brutal women calling themselves Honored Maters. He saw this as overconfidence and not audacity. A real audacity was in the arsenal of every student taught by the Bashar, Miles Teg. It also helped that Teg could be relied upon to improvise within the limits of a plan. Through his relays, Brismali followed the scrambling escape of Duncan and Lucilla. Troopers with comm helmets and night lenses created a great display of activity at the decoy positions, while Brismali and his select reserves kept watch on the attackers, never betraying their position. Teg's movements were easily followed by his violent response to the attackers. Brismali noted with approval that Lucilla did not pause when she heard the battle sounds intensify. Duncan, however, tried to stop and almost ruined the plan. Lucilla saved the moment by jabbing Duncan in a sensitive nerve and barking, "You can't help him." Hearing her voice clearly through his helmet amplifiers, Brismali cursed under his breath. Others would hear her, too. No doubt they were already tracking her, though. Brismali issued a sub-vocal command through the microphone implanted in his neck and prepared to abandon his post. He kept most of his attention on the approach of Lucilla and Duncan. If all went as planned, his people would bring down the pair of them while 2 helmetless and suitably garbed troopers continued the flight toward the decoy positions. In the interim, Teg was creating an admirable path of destruction through which a ground car might escape. An aide intruded on Brismali. 2 attackers are closing in behind the Bashar. Brismali waved the man aside. He could give little thought to Teg's chances. Everything had to be focused on saving the Gola. Brismali's thoughts were intense as he watched. "Come on. Run. Run, damn you." Lucilla held a similar thought as she urged Duncan forward, keeping herself close behind him to shield him from the rear. Everything about her was marshaled for ultimate resistance. Everything in her breeding and training came to the fore in these moments. Never give up. To give up was to pass her consciousness into the memory lives of a sister, or into oblivion. Even Shuang Yu had redeemed herself in the end by reverting to total resistance, and had died admirably in the Bene Gesserit tradition, resisting to the last. Brismali had reported it through Teg. Lucilla, assembling her uncounted lives, thought, "I can do no less." She followed Duncan down into a shallow swale beside the bowl of a great Pilingatum, and when people arose out of the darkness to drag them down, she almost responded in berserker mode, but a voice speaking to Kobsa in her ear said, "Friends." This delayed her response for a heartbeat while she saw the decoys continue the flight out of the swale. That, more than anything else, revealed the plan and the identity of the people holding them against the rich, leafy smells of the earth. When the people slid Duncan ahead of her into a tunnel aimed at the giant tree and, still under Kobsa, cautioned speed, Lucilla knew she was caught in a typical Teg-style audacity. Duncan saw it, too. At the Stygian outlet of the tunnel, he identified her by smell and tapped out a message against her arm in the old Atreides' silent battle language. "Let them lead." The form of the message startled her momentarily, until she realized that the Gola, of course, would know this communication method. Without speaking, the people around the room removed Duncan's bulky antique laser gun and hustled the fugitives into the hatch of a vehicle that she did not identify. A brief red light flared in the darkness. Burzmali spoke subvocally to his people. There they go. 28 ground cars and 11 flitter-thopters scrambled from the decoy positions. A proper diversion, Burzmali thought. Pressure in Lucilla's ears told her a hatch had been sealed. Again the red light flared and went dark. Explosives shattered the great tree around them, and their vehicle, now identifiable as an armored ground car, surged up and out on suspensors and jets. Lucilla could follow their course only by flashes of fire and the twisting patterns of stars visible through frames of oval plaz. The enclosing suspensor field made the motions eerie, sensed only by the eyes. They sat cradled in plasteel seats while their car rocketed downslope directly across Teg's holdout position, shifting and darting in violent changes of direction. None of this wild motion transmitted itself to the flesh of the occupants. There were only the dancing blurs of trees and brush, some of them burning, and then the stars. They were hugging the tops of the forest wreckage left by Teg's laser guns. Only then did she dare to hope that they might win free. Abruptly, their vehicle trembled into slow flight. The visible stars, framed by the tiny ovals of plaz, tipped and were obscured by a dark obstruction. Gravity returned, and there was dim light. Lucilla saw Burzmali fling open a hatch on her left. "Out," he snapped. "Not a second to spare." Duncan ahead of her, Lucilla scrambled out of the hatch onto damp earth. Burzmali thumped her back, grabbed Duncan's arm, and hustled them away from the car. "Quick! This way." They crashed through tall bushes onto a narrow paved roadway. Burzmali, a hand on each of them now, rushed them across the road and pushed them flat in a ditch. He whipped a life shield blanket over them and lifted his head to look back in the direction from which they had come. Lucilla peered past him and saw starlight on a snowy slope. She felt Duncan stir beside her. Far up the slope, a speeding ground car, its jet pod modifications visible against the stars, lifted on a plume of red, climbing, climbing, climbing. Suddenly, it darted off to the right. "Ours?" Duncan whispered. "Yes. How did it get up there without showing an abandoned aqueduct tunnel?" Burzmali whispered. "The car was programmed to go on automatic." He continued to stare at the distant red plume. Abruptly, a gigantic burst of blue light rolled outward from the faraway red tracery. The light was followed immediately by a dull thump. "Ah," Burzmali breathed. Duncan, his voice low, said, "They are supposed to think you overloaded your drive." Burzmali shot a startled look at the young face, ghostly gray in starlight. "Duncan Idaho was one of the finest pilots in Atreides' service," Lucilla said. It was an esoteric bit of knowledge, and it served its purpose. Burzmali saw immediately that he was not just guardian of two fugitives. His charges possessed abilities that could be used if needed. Blue and red sparks flashed across the sky where the modified ground car had exploded. The no-ships were sniffing that distant globe of hot gases. What would the sniffers decide? The blue and red sparks slipped down behind the starlit bulges of the hills. Burzmali whirled at the sound of footsteps on the roadway. Duncan had a handgun out so swiftly that Lucilla gasped. She put a restraining hand on his arm, but he shook it off. Didn't he see that Burzmali had accepted this intrusion? A voice called softly from the roadway above them. "Follow me. Hurry." The speaker, a moving blot of darkness, jumped down beside them and went crashing through a gap in the bushes lining the road. Dark spots on the snowy slope beyond the screening bushes resolved themselves into at least a dozen armed figures. Five of this party grouped themselves around Duncan and Lucilla and urged them silently along a snow-covered trail beside the bushes. The rest of the armed party ran openly down across the snow slope into a dark line of trees. Within 100 paces, the five silent figures formed their party into single file, two of their number ahead, three behind. The fugitives sheltered between them, with Bersmali leading and Lucilla close behind Duncan. They came presently to a cleft in dark rocks and under a ledge where they waited, listening to more modified ground cars thunder into the air behind them. "Decoys upon decoys," Bersmali whispered. "We overload them with decoys. They know we must flee in panic as fast as possible. Now we will wait nearby in concealment. Later we will proceed slowly on foot." "The unexpected," Lucilla whispered. "Take." It was Duncan, his voice little more than a breath. Bersmali leaned close to Duncan's left ear. "I think they got him." Bersmali's whisper carried a deep tone of sadness. One of their dark companions said, "Quickly now, down here." They were herded through the narrow cleft. Something emitted a creaking sound nearby. Hands hustled them into an enclosed passage. The creaking sounded from behind them.